This holiday afternoon, welcome everybody. We have four bills on the agenda today. Is anyone here to speak on House Bill 2591? That one, unless someone comes in and has traveled a goodly ways to get here, we're going to put that over. The proponents were not ready for the hearing today. But if someone to come in from the town, I wanted to make sure we got them on. Then we will proceed to Senate Bill 422, the Department of Revenue bill. I'll open a public hearing on that, and
Who's is that? Victor.
Okay. Do I have the sign-up sheet for that? It's coming.
Oops.
Deborah, is that you? Come on forward while he's giving
you see 422?
422.
Oh, here it is. I do have it. Can I read?
Just in out of order.
Mr. Chair, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. Bill is basically a housekeeping bill. In Section 2, what it does is extend the statute of limitations for 5 years when the department discovers for the other tobacco products tax. That provision is similar with respect to other taxes administered by the department. But if they discover a deficiency of 25% or more, it allows them to make an assessment at any time up to 5 years of that deficiency. The changes in Section 4, essentially, there's some wording changes, and then on line 22, the deletion of Section 2, makes it clear that cigarette tax reporting information that distributors report, is confidential information. And then Section 5 is basically saying provisions which relate to collection of the tax apply generally, which apply generally for the department, apply to the cigarette tax as well. That's
all right.
What the bill does.
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I think Dick has laid it out very well. We do look at this pretty much as a housekeeping bill, conforming to provisions in other tax programs, and then resolving a conflict with two bills that were passed in 1999, one of which said that these tax reports are confidential, and the other one said that they weren't. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them, but that's pretty much the bill.
Do I understand, Deborah, there's some uncertainty at this point as to whether the statute of limitations is 5 or 3?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We do have authority in statute to use the 5-year statute of limitations for a substantial understatement of gross income. So that would apply to personal taxpayers, corporate taxpayers, et cetera. The other tobacco tax product tax is imposed on purchases, net of discount. So they're not reporting any gross income. So it wasn't clear to us that we had that 5-year statute for that program.
And 5 years is consistent with the other limitations.
Mr. Chair, it is, yes.
Any other questions for Ms. Buchanan? I see that this was favorably received in the Senate. There are 29 votes in favor and one absent. No amendments?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill, on Senate Bill 422, and open a work session.
Yes, Chair.
Representative Beck.
Senate Bill 422 to the House floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves Senate Bill 422 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Yes.
Beck.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Excused.
Whip.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. Senate Bill 422 goes to the floor with the DuPass recommendation. We need a carrier.
I'll take that. Basis.
Okay.
The carrier.
That's fine. Representative Bates will be the carrier. That concludes our work on Senate Bill 422. Senate Bill 426 is next. I'll open a public hearing on that. Here to testify on that. Is that you again, Deborah? Come on. Okay. We're going to work on our scene changes here. That's right. Or at least a curtain. Ed, welcome. If you could give us the staff background on Senate Bill 426.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 426 is the Department of Revenue bill, and what it does is it affects some of the administration issues regarding non-resident income taxes. It exempts from Oregon income tax compensation earned by non-residents while serving as crew on pilots or pilots on vessels operating in interstate navigable waters. It also cancels tax assessments on compensation earned by non-resident crews for tax years since 1986. It also authorizes refunds for taxes paid by those non-resident crews since 1986. And it extends the current existing exemption from Oregon income tax for federal Columbia River hydroelectric workers to include contractors. This provision applies tax years beginning January 1, 1997 or thereafter. And finally, it establishes an Oregon income tax filing threshold for non-residents, and it sets that filing threshold equal to the current Oregon standard deduction amount.
Okay. Deborah, where on earth did this come from?
Chairman Shatterly, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Well, a little history might help on this one. The bill has three provisions. Two are dealing with federal limitations on the state's ability to tax non-residents, and the other one is simply a policy question. For the history part, in the overview that you had earlier in the session, we talked about state's ability to tax non-residents. Oregon has jurisdiction to tax a Washington resident who comes to Portland and works downtown in the office, will tax their wages. That's pretty clear. Oregon, like most states, uses a physical presence test. So if a person is physically present in Oregon and earning income, we will tax that income. If you think of a Washington resident who drives to the airport and gets on a jet and flies to New York and the next day gets on another jet and flies back, the compensation that person receives as pilot of that aircraft is subject to tax in every state that that jet crosses. Now, you can imagine the complexity of trying to determine the income that's attributable to every state while that pilot flies to New York and then flies back. In the 70s, Congress dealt with this issue for employers by providing that a maximum of two states can require reporting and taxation of that non-resident. And what Congress said was only the state of residence or the state that the employee works more than 50% of their time in can subject the wages to withholding. So the employer wasn't required to report to all of these states that that employee passed through, and withholding was not required. So that took care of the problem from the employer's standpoint, but it still left the employee with the burden of reporting and paying tax. And this is the key factor, is that withholding, being subject to withholding, is not the same as being subject to tax. So even though the employee might not be subject to withholding in those states, they could still be subject to taxation because they're really two different things. So after passing that law, Congress came back and said, not only are they not subject to withholding, but they're not subject to the income tax laws of the state where they're not a resident or where they don't work at least 50% of the time. But they only applied that to the interstate air carrier employees, and they left out the water carrier employees. So this is where the confusion starts. You had air carrier employees who were not subject to tax in any state except where the state of residence was or the state in which they worked more than 50% of the time. And in the 1990s, Congress passed another law that dealt with interstate motor carrier employees and interstate rail carrier employees. Those employees who are non-residents can't be taxed by the state at all. They might work 90% of their time in Oregon, but if they're a non-resident, they have regularly assigned duties, and they're an employee of an interstate motor carrier or an interstate rail carrier, Oregon doesn't tax the wages. Again, the water carrier employees were left out of this. So there was a lot of confusion in the water carrier employee industry as to whether or not they were subject to tax, because they were not subject to withholding by Oregon, but they were still subject to tax. And it's difficult for most people to understand the distinction. So what we had were employees who were working on the Columbia River, running charged tugs up and down the Columbia, not filing returns with Oregon because they thought they were exempt from Oregon tax, when actually they were only exempt from Oregon withholding. And there were several efforts at the federal level to take care of these. Finally, in October of 2000, Congress did pass a bill that exempts non-resident employees with regularly assigned duties on the waterways of two states from taxation in a non-resident state. So that takes care of these employees prospectively, but it still left the outstanding issues for older years. When we brought the bill forward, we had in there a date of 1993, because that was the earliest information we had to indicate that we had done some enforcement action. After the bill was filed, we had correspondence from Representative Brian Baird's office in Washington, and there were a few taxpayers who went back to 1986. So that's where the amendment to the bill came in. We went to 1986. And what this would do, if it's enacted, would allow us to cancel assessments for years 1986 and later that are outstanding. If taxpayers have actually filed and paid, they would be able to claim a refund if they fit this situation. So that's the first part of it. The second part, having to do with federal legislation, is related to the four dams on the Columbia River. Federal legislation was passed to provide that non-residents who work on one of those four dams are not subject to Oregon tax. Technically, if they're working on the dam, the state line runs down the middle of the river. They walk back and forth across that dam during the day. During the time that they're on the Oregon side, they would be subject to Oregon tax. So federal legislation was passed to provide that they aren't subject to tax. However, in 1997, this legislature passed a similar provision mirroring what the federal eventually passed. So it's in Oregon law, but what the federal law applied to was only federal employees working on one of the dams. It didn't extend to self-employed or independent contractors who might come in from out of state and work on the dam for a period of time. So we're asking simply whether there's a good reason to have that difference. Should an independent contractor coming in from Florida to work 3 months on the dam be treated the same as a federal employee? And that's really a policy question. It does have retroactive effect in the bill to 1997, which was when it was first enacted for Oregon. Finally, the third part of the bill, as Ed said, establishes a threshold for non-resident filing. And under the existing law, a non-resident who works in Oregon for any period of time, as little as 4 hours, as little as a day, and is compensated for that time in Oregon, has a filing requirement, and they would have a tax liability. You have an example that we worked up with two different fact patterns. One, a married joint filing with two exemptions, and one, a single exemption. In the single exemption, you can see that the Oregon income for this person is $100. Maybe they came into Oregon for a conference, and $40,000 of their total income, $100 was attributable to working in Oregon. If you work down through this example, you'll see that the way the percentages work to allow them their standard deduction and their federal tax subtraction, they actually end up with a liability after all credits of $3.66. So that's existing law. The proposal in the bill is to establish a filing threshold of gross income equal to the standard deduction. For a married couple, that would then be $3,000. For a single filer, that would be $1,800. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
What's going through my head, I can't formulate a question because I think these are probably pretty technical and small, but I guess I'm thinking about the issue of Oregon having an income tax and Washington not having one at all. And are there do these bills do anything that create an additional incentive for people to fudge about how much they're working here and living there? I don't think that's the case, but I'm just I know they're
people who do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we know there are people who do that as well. That's really difficult to answer. Our feeling is that for the people in this example, say $100 of income, they probably aren't filing with us now.
Right.
I think a lot of people aren't aware of the requirement to file.
Right.
So would it cause an incentive to perhaps under apportion income to Oregon and say that I only had $2,500 of wages from Oregon when actually it was $3,500? That may be. And that could be a concern.
Just hypothetically, so if I work on the Bonneville powerhouse and I live in Washington, but I spend all my time doing something for the feds at the fish hatchery in Oregon. I'm thinking Bonneville now. But I live across the river in Stevenson somewhere. The bill would exempt, if we weren't dealing with federal employees, the person would have to pay Oregon income tax, right? They live in Washington State, they work in Oregon, their duties are performed in Oregon, they pay Oregon income tax. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, that's correct, unless, in your example, unless they were a federal employee,
right,
and they were working at the hydroelectric facility, then they would be exempt. If they're not a federal employee, or they're not working at the hydroelectric facility, then they would be taxed on their wages.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to get into minutia about things I don't understand well enough, but kind of curious to make sure.
That's what we do.
I know. I've never been much of a minutia person, so I'm going to start now.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harris.
Thank you. Can you tell me exactly, roughly, how many people this would affect in terms of the refunds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, moving it from 93 to 1986 picked up about six people that we were made aware of. Now, there could conceivably be others that we don't know about, but I think for most of the people who were the waterway workers, non-residents, regularly assigned duties running up and down the Columbia River, our feeling is most of those people weren't filing because they honestly thought that they were exempt from tax under federal law. And it was came as a surprise to them to find out that actually Oregon did have the ability to tax that income.
So total, you added six. So the total people getting refunds, the total number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, actually, there weren't even six that would get refunds. There were some who had not filed, but they made contact with Representative Baird's office, and they would be covered under this, but they had not filed. So I think it's actually fewer than six that would be getting refunds for that.
All right, any other questions? So I guess the policy question in the middle part is whether to treat, I would say, similarly situated workers the same. Is that it? You've got federal and non-federal workers employed side by side on these dam hydroelectric projects?
Mr. Chair, yes. That's the policy question for the dam workers, is whether whether the federal employees should be treated differently than other persons working on the same facility.
And the constraints on taxation to federal employees are imposed by federal law.
Mr. Chair, that's
correct. Okay, so we're faced with aligning hours with that and then extending it to those other non-federal employees.
Mr. Chair, the alignment with federal law did occur, so it's only...
As to federal employees,
that's
yeah.
Correct, yes.
All right. Any other questions? Is anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 426? If not, I will close the public hearing and go ahead and open the work session on Senate Bill 426. So it's your pleasure.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
If I understand correctly, this bill provides the same benefits to non-resident, non-federal government employees as the federal law requires of federal employees.
That's right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 426 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves Senate Bill 426 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? If not, please call the roll.
Representative Spang.
Yes.
Matt.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Pat.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Witt.
Aye.
Senator Strassman.
Aye.
Capari.
Aye.
Chair Shatterman. Aye. Senate Bill 426 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Carrier. Representative Brown,
I'll do it.
Beck, okay. Saved by the...
Saved by the Beck.
Saved by the Beck. Okay, that will conclude the work session on Senate Bill 426. Now, working without a net, but I think I've got this right, the chair requests unanimous consent to suspend the rules and return to work session on Senate Bill 422, to allow Representatives Williams and Cafori. Anybody else? To cast a vote. Is there any objection? Hearing none, we are in work session on Senate Bill 422. Representative Cafori, how do you vote?
Aye.
Votes aye. Representative Williams?
Votes aye.
Votes aye. Got those votes, and we are out of work session then, and we will proceed straight away to Senate Bill 329. Open the work session on that. Welcome. Oh, we're getting the whole crew today, aren't we? We call this an ensemble play.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, you have Senate Bill 329 before you. And what it is, it's eliminating the sunset date of July 1st, 2002 on the tax exemption for higher education parking facilities. So now, under current law, the state-owned parking facilities can be rented and used by employees and students, and the property taxes are exempt. And Senate Bill 329 provides a property tax exemption for parking facilities, which also can be used by visitors. Usually, these parking structures have a variety of parking, student, employee, and visitors. And so in those instances, the county has already removed a lot of these parking structures from the tax rolls under existing law. So as a little bit of background, a property tax exemption for students and employee parking facilities, which are owned by Oregon University System, was established in 1989 with a sunset date July 1st, 1993. Then the sunset date was later extended in the 93 session as well as in the 95 session, which currently places it under the sunset date of July 1st, 2002. So the exemption was created to provide low parking fees for employees and students of Oregon universities, and all 8 higher education campuses rent parking spaces to students and employees, and the property, which is owned by the Oregon Health Science University, is already exempt from property taxes because the university is a public corporation. So basically, with the revenue impact, you do have an impact from just the fact that you are eliminating now that sunset date in current law. In 2002-03, if you did not take any action, you would see an increase in local tax dollars, about $1.9 million in the 2002-03 biennium, or 2002-03 year. So it's about $2 million a year. But under current law, we also see that as far as this extending this to visitors, that portion of the change in law should not really create any additional change or additional parking facilities going off the roll, because at this time most counties already take off the higher education parking facilities, even though they may include a few spaces for visitors, because it is pretty difficult for county assessors to go out and portion out a parking facility's spaces according to visitors. So this change is really just making the law consistent with the assessment practices of Oregon counties already.
Okay. Grattan, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Cairns, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. Mm-hmm. And the Senate Bill 329 comes to you at the request of the State Board of Higher Education. it is simply asking you to make permanent a temporary exemption, which has been repeatedly and without much controversy extended by the legislature for some almost 30 years now. The measure as it's drafted would simply say that one entity of government would not tax the parking facilities and structures of another arm of government and raise the prices for the government service that we provide in order to transfer money over from our general budgets to a municipality. So the revenue impact is represents what would have been if the sunset were to expire and does not represent lost dollars because they've never been collected. The bill does add the word visitors because it's been ambiguous. We do have visitors who come to campuses. They may, if they are given a visitor spot, use a student spot or other spot that's not otherwise directly designated for a faculty or staff person. And we wanted to make sure that those were included, so we've added that word. Those do not include any leased spaces or spaces which are used by persons who do not come to the universities for other than visiting for purposes of the university. Mr. George Pernsteiner will be testifying next and speak to the issues at Portland State University, where the majority of the income would come if this sunset were to expire and the tax were imposed, and he can talk directly to that. So we're here asking you to make permanent what the legislature has on numerous occasions in the past extended so that we would not have to raise the cost to our students and faculty, raise our prices, and otherwise act as a collection agent for local governments for their taxes. It would also, of course, put us in the same category as independent colleges in Oregon who under 501c3s are exempt from this permanently and or do not pay these taxes. And answer any questions that they might have.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Cairns?
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Carlson.
Thank you. Can you tell us why Senator Minnis voted no on the Senate side in committee?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, because he asked a question regarding leased spaces. I told him I would do a survey of that. I returned the survey to him, but although it was received by his office prior to the vote, did not apparently see it. It was in his bill file. Our survey found a spot at the University of Oregon campus, which was leased to some folks there on the University Village for loading-unloading zone. And he wanted to know if there was any other spots other than those you'll hear from Mr. Pernsteiner in the system. I gave him that response back, but apparently, although the letter was delivered to his office the same day as the hearing, either the letter went to the bill file and wasn't seen or was misfiled.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grattan, should we conclude from your testimony that higher taxes lead to higher prices?
Mr. Chairman, the dollars go somewhere, and the dollars come from somewhere.
Remember that.
For the record, Mr. Chairman. Bit of humor from a good representative.
Other questions? All right, thank you, then. Mr. Pernsteiner? Pernsteiner. I think that's it. I'm sorry. There's probably a few more I could try.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. George Pernsteiner with Portland State University, and I do not print very well, and that's probably why you didn't. I think Mr. Cairns provided most of the information which I wanted to convey. I would note that I provided to you both a written testimony from on behalf of Portland State and one on behalf of the Health Sciences University's Mark Van Busker, who unfortunately could not be here. If PSU had to pay the tax in at the current rates, that would be about a $740,000 a year cost to the university. If we pass that through in our parking rates, that would be about a 36% increase in those rates in order to pay the tax. And that's one of the reasons that as we attempt to keep the rates affordable, we would hope that you would be willing to make this exemption permanent. As Mr. Cairns indicated, we have always enjoyed this exemption. It has been sunsetted at various times and come up for renewal and review, and we are requesting this time that it be made permanent. With respect to the visitors, there had been questions about visitors. What we are talking about are people who come in to the campus for short periods of time to participate in campus-based activities. And the reason this question came up is because we recently bought a parking garage in downtown Portland, several of the spaces in which are leased on a long-term basis to private entities. Those spaces would be taxable. And we're working out with the Multnomah County Assessor now how to make that an easy thing for them and us to administer. Once those long-term agreements expire, we will just put those into our general pool, and that will no longer be an issue. But the reason I think that the question arose as to what we meant by visitors dealt with not just the in-and-out short-termers, but those long-term leases. Those long-term leases are not exempt and would not be under this bill.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. President? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before I move away from the witness stand, Mr. Barrows is going to come up and request some amendments. We have visited with him. I have spoken directly to the governor's office regarding them. They have no objection. I've spoken to the campuses. They have no objection, nor does the Finance and Administration Office of the University System.
And this was the amendment for the broad intangibles? Mm-hmm.
No,
I heard it was Mr. Barrows.
Got that one. If he's got that one, I want to.
Oh, did I get this wrong?
Wrong bill.
Did we get the amendments? No, I didn't. I missed.
Oh, yeah.
Did they move on to the amendments?
No. Yes, sure.
But no.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Forest Homeowners Association. With me is the president of the association, Cindy Banzer, who just coincidentally happens to be a former member of this body some years ago, served with a distinction. And as indicated, we are asking to couple with the same bill that we coupled with in effect in 1995, which is the parking structure bill. And we're very grateful to all of the people who are sponsoring that legislation to allow us to join them. Probably the best way to proceed, most of you have received this, which you are now receiving again, which pretty much outlines the program. Ms. Banzer will make some comments, and then we have a suggestion as to how the amendments might proceed. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Banzer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Banzer. My address is 6833 Southeast Pine Court, Portland, Oregon, 97215. I am the president of the Oregon Forest Homeowners Association, affectionately known as OFA. This is a statewide organization of people who own cabins on U.S. Forest Service lands. And there are about 1,600 of these cabins in Oregon. I'd also like to note that the vice president of our organization, Jim Bushnell, is in the audience with us today. We are here to talk about the possessory interest tax. It's a mouthful that people stumble over what exactly is it. Oregon law provides that a tax assessment, which is known as a possessory interest tax, can be levied against land that is leased from the U.S. Forest Service. In our case, it's called the Summer Home or Recreational Residence Program. This fee is determined by taking the value of the land, the fair market value of the land, times the tax rate of the county where the cabin is located. We have felt in the legislature in 1975, 98, and 95 agreed with us that this is considered double taxation because we currently pay 25% of our annual fee that goes to the government goes back to the county. For example, in Mount Hood, out of the $2,200 fee that we will be paying, 25% of that will go back to Clackamas County. A possessory interest tax would essentially return that same amount again a second time. When the exemption was requested in the previous legislative bodies, there were no objections. And we would like to ask you today to consider continuing this exemption once again. As a little background, the Act of 1915 that Congress passed allowed the Secretary of Agriculture to set up a program called the Recreational Residence Program. At that time, it took a day or two to get from your home to the forest, and you had, because you were using, some type of primitive car or mostly horses. And so they wanted people to be able to put a tent or a minimal cabin on a piece of land, and that's why the program came to be. Most of the cabins are still very rustic. They're considered fishing cabins. They are very small. They are certainly not in the genre of Salishan or Black Butte or Sun River. These are truly little cabins in the woods. Many of them do not have electricity or running water today. One of the issues, and this is a little complicated, so try to bear with me. The value that we come up, that the Forest Service comes up with to determine the annual permit is based on the fair market value of the land, of a lot that we essentially are responsible for. We do not have exclusive use of that lot. The only exclusive use we have is the actual footprint that the cabin is on. In other words, Representative Kapori, if you wanted to come up to where our cabin is and pitch a tent there, have a picnic there, you could do that. It is in no way secluded. There are no fences. There's no way that the public is kept off of that. So we are paying, however, a fee on the assumption that we had this entire amount of property at our disposal. We're currently paying about, let me use the example of Mount Hood, a $2,200 annual permit fee. And I must note that we did have federal legislation that passed and was signed into law in October that we hope will moderate that fee. In addition, we pay almost $500 in property taxes to Clackamas County. And if this possessory interest tax exemption is not continued, we will pay an additional $500 each year, which is about $3,100, $3,200 a year. Now, this is for land that we have absolutely no control over. We don't own it. We can be asked to vacate it at any time. Anybody has access to it. We are not allowed to cut down trees or clean out the vegetation. We cannot paint the cabins without approval of the Forest Service. There's extreme amount of restrictions, and we have included for your information two pieces that will go into more detail on the restrictions that we face. One is Exhibit 1, and one is the additional packet that you have that talks about the possessory interest tax fees. And I draw your attention to both pages 4 and 5 that go through that in some detail. We're really asking you today to please consider not taxing us twice on land that we really don't even have control over. We are pleased that the governor recommended that the exemption be continued, and we hope that you will feel comfortable recommending also that this exemption be continued. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Barrows.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have before you a separate piece of paper. It's also on the last page of the packet that Ms. Banzer talked about, an LC draft of a bill that the chair very kindly agreed to have brought forward. It was prepared by someone else, but gave us a note, and then I decided it would make more sense to use to expedite the process by combining it with the other bill that we were combined with in 1995. So this cannot be adopted today because it's not an amendment form, but this is the essence of it. There is one additional thing that we would like to do, Mr. Chairman, ask the committee to do if it looks favorably on the notion, and that is in the case of the three provisions that we're talking about, which deal with recreational facilities and the two that deal with cabins, that those three provisions have their sunset moved out 10 years. It would be a 10-year exemption, and it would come back up again before the 2011 legislative session. We would hope you would not do that in the case of the parking structures, that you would leave that portion of the bill as it is, agree to this thing, but with an extension, not an abolishment of the exemption. So that's our request. The counties have asked for that, and with that, I am permitted to say on their behalf that they have no problem with the bill.
And you're satisfied with the 10-year extension?
My client is satisfied with the 10-year extension. So are the recreation facilities folks. Okay.
Well, let's see, Representative Brown and Bates and Carlson and Hess could be members of the legislature still in 10 years. Maybe they'll remember. We pass you the institutional memory. Okay, appreciate that. Anything else then?
No.
Making sure that Elizabeth gets the notes on that, so we will follow through with those requests.
Thank you, Mr.
And thank you for coming forward.
Yes,
does anybody else wish to be heard today on Senate Bill 329, either the bill in chief or the amendment? Okay, then unless I hear a strong objection from the committee, I will ask Elizabeth to obtain the amendments that will incorporate LC 2785 into Senate Bill 329 with the provision that the amendment will include a 10-year extension of the sunset applicable only to the subject of the LC 2785 and not applicable to the bill in chief. Okay? Then we will not be in a position to take action on that today, so I will close the public hearing unless, again, somebody stands up really quickly and says they want to be heard. And I think that concludes our business for the day.